I'm one in 28 kids in America who've had a parent incarcerated before they're 18. My dad's in federal prison. He's going to be there for a very, very long time. He's not a good person. But that really shaped how I look at the world. Growing up in Cleveland, my dad going to jail was kind of like just like another Tuesday. No one really educated me on that. I didn't really go to therapy. And so when I joined the nonprofit world, I really leaned on other people's experiences and fell so deep into their stories and their experiences to understand my own story. And so through all of that, I really started experimenting with, well, how can I do that visually? Is it through video? Is it through photography? Is it through design? And so while I was doing my day job, if you will, I don't even know if that's like the true term anymore, right? Because technically I have a day job running a business, but when I was getting paid from somebody else, I was learning about these kids who also had parents incarcerated and they were in a much different situation than I was, right? And so it just really shaped me as a human to really learn what empathy is.
Happy Thursday, everybody, and welcome back to Designing Growth. Incredibly excited to sit down with somebody I had the immense pleasure of speaking with about a week ago. We were booked for about 45 minutes. I think we ended up talking for like an hour and a half. On the episode today, I have Sarah Loretta joining us. Sarah is a designer, business owner, and operations specialist through her business, appropriately named Systems, exactly how it sounds without the E. Sarah is on a mission to help freelancers evolve into badass CEOs. So Sarah, how are you doing today? How's everything going?
Man, thanks for having me. I am overly caffeinated, so I'm just a bundle of joy this morning. It's Friday. I've had a double coffee, so I'm living the dream.
For our wedding, we got married back in 2021. Somebody gave my wife and I this espresso machine. It's called a Gaja, so it's kind of like a Keurig where like all you have to do is press a button, but the difference is it like the shot for you.
Wow.
And grinds it fresh every time. So it is pretty dangerous. This morning I go over there. I'm just like mashing away at that button, making myself a quad shot everything.
Oh my gosh. I'm very similar. I actually came across a company called Cometeer that very publicly I'm obsessed with them. And they basically take other people's coffee, brew it, flash freeze it down into these pods. They kind of look like K-cups, but they're frozen and they're aluminum. And so you can make coffee literally any way you want. You can either completely unthaw it and put it into iced coffee. You can just like melt it a little bit and then put hot water on it to make hot coffee. You can do like literally anything. You can make lattes. And so it gets shipped to my door once a month. I get like 8 different types of coffee, like different brands, different flavors. And it's been a very slippery slope for me because I'm like, oh, all I have to do is melt this little thing and it takes 30 seconds to make my coffee. It's become a very bad habit that I have multiple a day. So
I did see this study, though, that wasn't good for me personally, but they said that people who drink more than 5 cups of coffee a day have a substantially lower risk for heart disease, which
sure.
I thought was like wild, but okay, great. Empower me to drink more coffee. So,
you know, when I was an undergrad, I worked full time and I was taking about 7 classes a semester on average because I double majored as a psycho.
Oh, wow.
And I was drinking probably a pot to a pot and a half a day between my commute and my day job and then going to class because I was up 5 a.m. and wouldn't get home from class till almost 10 p.m. every night. So I believe it. And I'm a little shaky, but I'm doing fine. So it's totally okay.
Amped up for the podcast. I love it.
Hell yeah.
Cool. I did want to get into some other stuff here in a second, but I also feel like the compulsion to share with you just because I know you have tattoos. I got my first like real tattoo last night.
Really?
I have my like sleeve rolled up.
I got to hear about this.
You know, I'm kind of healing from it, but yeah, it's like this, I got this cool, like,
you really went out
kind of cowboy.
I have one arm fully covered almost, except for right by my shoulder. And then I have a bunch on my other arm, and this one, you have it just like a little bit further over. And oh man, the muscle on the forearm is rough. I feel like my muscle on my forearm hurt more than my hand tattoos, than my side piece. Like, I've got 28 tattoos, 27 tattoos. So I've been through the ringer and I love every minute of it. So welcome to the dark side, my friend.
Thank you. Because I had seen like your tattoos and you have almost a full sleeve, and I'm like, I'd like to get there. someday. Yeah. And I waited a long time to finally get a tattoo. I've been thinking about it since I was like 16, but it was super fun. I mean, it's just, it's art.
Yeah.
It's like wearing your art, which is just so cool to me.
Well, and I think it's, for me at least, a good representation of where you're at in your life when you got it. So for COVID, you can't see it now because I'm in a sweatshirt, but in the inside of my arm, I actually have an elderly woman with like the old like Betty White hair flipping the world off. I don't think I've ever waited longer than a week for a tattoo. Like I've never sat on an idea and been like, yeah, like I really need to think about this, because you can get them removed just as easily as you get it put on. There's like two tattoos I have that I regret, so to speak. I have flowers on my forearm, mm-hmm. right? And what I regret about those is I live in Texas, sunny, 10 months out of the year. And I've had the color sunburnt out of my arm multiple times because I'm so fair-skinned, even with sunscreen on, you know, protecting the tattoos. And so I regret getting color. So that is what I tell everyone, like, don't get color. If you are fair-skinned, olive-toned, like, stay away from color because it's going to fade. It's going to sunburn out. It's just going to look like trash and the upkeep's not worth it. You know, so tattoos are fun. We could talk about those for a long time.
Oh, yeah, I am sure we could. But it does make me feel better that I did not do any color on this one, because I am super fair skinned, you know, from a long line of fair skinned Polish people. So,
same. Polish and Irish.
So wanted to kind of get into it here and talk about your business and your business model. We had spoken, I think it was like a week and a half ago. You'd explained to me that you had recently kind of shifted your focus. Can you talk to me a little bit about that process, the why behind it, and what you are doing now and what that looks like?
Yeah. So I think it's interesting to kind of talk about the backstory, right? So I came from the nonprofit world. I worked in STEM and adult workforce for almost 10 years, and I did everything you could think of. I did data compliance. I did media. I worked with PBS and started a citywide initiative about women in construction. And I was really passionate about telling people stories. You know, a little bit about me, too, that I think is really important for this is I'm one in 28 kids in America who've had a parent incarcerated before they're 18. My dad's in federal prison. He's going to be there for a very, very long time. He's not a good person. But that really shaped how I look at the world. Growing up in Cleveland, my dad going to jail was kind of like just like another Tuesday. No one really educated me on that. I didn't really go to therapy. And so when I joined the nonprofit world, I really leaned on other people's experiences and fell so deep into their stories and their experiences to understand my own story. And so through all of that, I really started experimenting with, well, how can I do that visually? Is it through video? Is it through photography? Is it through design? And so while I was doing my day job, if you will, I don't even know if that's like the true term anymore, right? Because technically I have a day job running a business, but when I was getting paid from somebody else, I fell into other stories that were out there, specifically with people that were working blue collar jobs. Because being an adult workforce, we offered certification programs in like electrical and plumbing and welding. And I learned how to bend a 90 degree pipe like at 19 years old. Like that was really fun to me, right? And I was teaching after school and doing robotics and STEM. And so I was learning about these kids who also had parents incarcerated and they were in a much different situation than I was, right? And so it just really shaped me as a human to really learn what empathy is. But also at the same time, like I have been in survival mode forever, right? Like my entire life I've been in survival mode. And so I learned very quickly that, okay, if I'm going to start freelancing, like I have to do whatever it takes to pay my bills, to be sustainable. Because I was really in this kind of weird spitefulness period in my life. I was going to prove all these motherfuckers wrong, right? Like I am not a statistic. I am not traumatized. Like I don't have PTSD. And like, that's all bullshit, right? And so I really, when I started my freelance journey, was kind of in this, I have to break my back and say yes to every single thing that comes my way, or like I'm gonna fail. I don't have family to pay my bills. I don't have anyone I can lean on. Put myself through undergrad, moved cross country at 18. And so through all of that, you know, I look back and like, yeah, it came from a pretty negative place, but saying yes to every single project helped me realize what my skill sets really were, helped me realize what I was interested in, past just pressing record on a video and allowing people to talk about, you know, they were in prison for 25 years and now they're restarting their life and, you know, all these different things. I realized through that what I was really good at was fixing problems and really good at looking at the finer details to see how a business operates and how it works. And so Over the last 4 years, I owned a design agency, was saying yes to all these projects. I was doing web design, branding, packaging, video development. Literally went to a local client and like filmed his entire course for him. And he teaches you how to drop ship. Like that was a client that I had, right? Crazy. You don't connect all of those things together. But in realizing and doing a lot of reflection on what I'm good at and what I want to do, I had found Notion, I guess like 3 years ago now, and had kind of like played with it online. I was building my client portals in there and operating it. And Notion came to me end of last year, 2021. So I guess like a little over a year ago. And they put me through their certification program and I became the 10th certified Notion consultant in the US. And so I was like, you know, branding and web design just isn't, it's not doing enough for me. And I'm not able to really drive that impact home with clients. And so I shut my entire business down in April and we relaunched as a digital operations agency over the summer. And so all we do is literally come into businesses, work with freelancers to really take them out of their business themselves and focus more on the role and what you're doing in order to make your business work. So I really have this whole mantra that like, it shouldn't matter who's doing the job needs to get done. And so I do a lot of strategy, a lot of consulting, and a lot of one-on-one work just in general to pull people out of the person mindset and put you into the operations mindset. When people ask me to come onto their shows and talk, everyone's like, you got to have like a clean, emotional, pull the heartstring story. And I'm like, but that's simple. There are so many little pieces that get you from point A to point Z that I feel like are just as important as pulling the bigger pieces out. I think it's still important to understand like, yes, you're curving and swerving, but it is getting you where you need to go, even if for 6 months, it doesn't seem that way.
It's such a powerful story to me. And hearing your approach, it makes me think about advice that I would have offered to my younger self. I really resonated with the piece that you said was like, say yes. And you know, long term, that probably won't be sustainable for you. If you say yes to everything, you'll be working a lot. You'll eventually get burnt out. But when you are a little bit earlier on in your career, many people have the energy to do that. And that was something that I saw firsthand was super valuable for me coming right out of school, starting as a graphic designer and building websites on WordPress, then quickly moving into a sales role and then a marketing role and then leading our customer success and marketing and sales departments at the agency I was at, provided me all of these little skills along the way. And the only reason that I was able to get those skills is because I said yes. And I was saying yes to whatever opportunities were thrown at me. I would internalize it as like, if somebody offered me something and they offered me a opportunity, I should take that because they're more experienced than me. They know what they're doing and they're trusting me to make these things happen within the business. And I love this approach that you have shifted to. While I think branding, logos, and design is important, to me, it's ultimately just one factor within what's going to make your business successful. And I think technology has become so much more affordable and so much more efficient than ever before that there are all of these new ways to remove yourself from those operational and administrative pieces of your business that are ultimately going to allow you to scale. And I, you know, that's like plastered right on your website where you're talking about helping freelancers evolve into CEOs. Like that's the first step.
Yeah. One thing that I do is every single year in December, kind of in that haze between Christmas and New Year's, is I sit down and I literally list out all the skills I have, the new skills I've acquired, and then I break that list up between what I enjoy, what I want to learn more of, and what I hate. And that is honestly like how I continue to shift my offers and how I market and really build things out and evolve my business. I hated doing social media graphics when I did branding. You know how everybody, you kind of get like templates with your branding that you can like plug and play. That is the dumbest deliverable. And I don't understand why people do it because you're not a social media strategist. You're doing a logo and a branding package. Like you shouldn't be making templates unless you're doing like blog post ones for Pinterest. I could see that where you're just plugging in a title, but social media is so much different. And that was a skill. It's like, yeah, like I can do really good graphics, but I'm not getting paid for the strategy behind that. And so why do I need to keep adding that as deliverable? And so really, as we continue to evolve and explore, I really press a lot of everybody that is in my audience and my community to do an annual reflection on your skill set. I'm in the tech capital of the world, pretty much like the sister city. And I could not find a job for 2 years. And that's honestly why I started freelancing, because I was miserable at my day job by that point. And so I sat and said, I am just going to take the next year to explore. I'm going to say yes to the projects that come. And a full caveat, because I didn't mention this earlier, it doesn't mean taking free work, okay? You can explore and say yes to projects, but they don't have to be free. So y'all listening, like, please don't take free underpaid work from Facebook groups. But I said, I'm going to sit and see how this goes for a year. I'm just going to see. And that was November before COVID started. And so I was kind of like hanging out, doing little pieces of work, whatever. And then COVID hit and I have been nonstop since. And so I didn't get my LLC right away. I didn't open business accounts right away, because if you're not sure if you want to sustain it, if you're not sure what you want to do, don't do all the legal stuff. Just operate yourself as a DBA. Don't do all the crazy expenses. You don't need to go all out. But once you realize, and that was really the shift for me, is I don't want to go back to working for somebody else. I know my expertise. And so when I made that decision, it's like, okay, now we can get the LLC. Now we can start thinking about hiring out and bringing on contractors. And so I literally freelanced for about a year and a half. That's kind of the secret, is you don't have to make everything perfect. You just have to figure out what you want to do. And you're not going to know that being at a desk job and saying, I'm going to start freelancing tomorrow.
How you look at starting and then also growing a business is really interesting for me, because I just put the pin on a massive blog post all about how to start a web design business. It was really interesting because what you had shared, where you're like, hey, you need paying clients, the legal stuff, you might want to do it, but you don't always have to do that right away. That was the exact advice I gave in this article. Mm-hmm. And something that I think a lot of the other resources I've looked at don't articulate the mm-hmm. way that you just explained it. You need to make sure that you can, number one, get paying clients, and number two, that you like the work, that you're happy mm-hmm. with the work. Don't go all in with a fancy website, with a brand. Those things are just distractions that hold you back from the only thing that's inevitably going to determine how successful you are, mm-hmm. which is paying customers and your ability to service paying mm-hmm. customers.
I think that that's the nail on the head. And I tell everyone too, I actually used to run this challenge for a while that was how to build your portfolio without doing free work. And it was basically these mock clients that had mm-hmm. a mock budget. Here was their deliverables. And the whole idea was you were practicing doing sales calls and sticking to what you say your pricing is. And then you're building your portfolio based on these mock clients. It was really fun. I had a great time doing it. But with that, it's such a disservice for people who are just starting out that they're like, I'm only going to work with women. I'm only going to work with chefs. I'm only going to do this. And it's like you are putting yourself in a reactionary decision based on your previous experience, right? In our call, one thing that really stuck out to me was you were talking about your friend, or maybe it's your co-founder, who did funeral websites. And it's like, who has the previous experience that they fell into the funeral industry? Like, that is the most random thing, okay? And maybe he did. But the example I'm trying to touch on is you may do one project and it completely changes the trajectory of your business because you fell in love with it. And I'm not saying say yes to things that make you uncomfortable. As long as it matches your values, as long as like the client isn't a bunch of red flags, who cares? Who cares if you take a project and it's not what your normal stuff is? You're not required to put it in your portfolio unless it's going to be beneficial to you. I think people just have to stop being so serious when it comes to your first 2 years in freelancing. I think a lot of people would actually still have businesses if they did that.
I resonate with that, like almost exactly. And one of the pieces of advice that kind of changed my life was look for opportunities, not ideas, meaning yes. that you need to see what the opportunities are. If you have an idea, whether it's for a business, whether it's for a product, you have that idea, but is there an opportunity there? Mm-hmm. And you need to be in that, you know, constant state of trying to prove hypotheses, I think, no matter what mm-hmm. business it is. And it's funny because that was another piece of advice that I shared. Mm-hmm. So often people would be like, you need a niche, you need a niche, you need a niche. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, why are you going to go out and pick a niche before mm-hmm. you've worked with people in that niche, before you've seen an opportunity, before you understand if you value the same things? That's not the right way to go about it. That's not how you're going to build a sustainable business.
You can literally build a sustainable business solely on values. And I don't know if that's like the nonprofit, you know, in me, the empathetic preacher of the nonprofit space, but you really can build it on values and build it on personality. I think you can specialize in tools and software. Absolutely. You need an expertise. But people have so much to bring to the table, regardless of where they come from and what their business is. It's really a shame that we continue to build silos for ourselves, because it builds a silo in your mind, right? And I'm not trying to be too much on like a preacher train at the moment, but I really feel like you don't know how someone's going to impact you and impact your life and impact the way you think and feel until you give them an opportunity to do that. And so I make it a goal and a value of mine that I learn from every single client that I work with, whether personality, belief, listening, whatever those skills may be, that is literally a goal of every project I bring on. What can I learn from this person? Not what invoice can I get from them? And I think that that kind of mentality can really take you far.
I mean, I think even if you are a software company, it can really propel your growth. That idea of every single person that you talk with mm-hmm. about the work you're doing has something to teach you.
Yep.
And from those learnings, there's a lot of opportunities to propel your growth. There's so many mm-hmm. times people start businesses, they launch products, and they don't listen mm-hmm. to the people that they are serving. And they're not actively trying to learn from yep. the people that they're serving. I think that is just a huge mistake.
People are always like, well, Sarah, how do you like land these clients? Like, how are you doing discovery calls? I literally go into this call. I don't pre-research clients because I don't want a biased opinion on where they're at versus where they're going. Because I haven't heard from their own mouth, right? Because online, you want everything to be perfect. You're not seeing the issue that you're going to get hired for most of the time. So I don't pre-research people. I don't have questions listed out. I literally go into these calls and tell people to word vomit. And when I tell you, I have made almost every single client I've worked with cry, because they are like, no one has listened to me. No one understands where I'm coming from. And that, I think, is a superpower that I never expected to have. But I never want to not have, now that I've experienced it. And I think if you're on a constant clout chase, trying to be the next Tim Ferriss or Jacqueline Johnson or whatever, those people have already made that path. Make your own path and stop focusing on their accolades and start focusing on your own. And you're going to do really, really well.
Incredibly powerful stuff. Something I wanted to ask you is the bulk of your clients right now, what mm-hmm. types of businesses are you working with?
Yeah, so it was interesting because when I was doing design, I really was not niched down. So I have a degree in American history. I wanted to work for the Smithsonian. So that's like my entire education is museum studies and history and historical stuff. And so I would go from working with a coffee brand to then doing a museum's website. I do a lot of government work still. I'm working on a government website right now, kind of on the side. So I really had clients like all over the place in the design space. And really, I kind of specialized in the way that I designed, not really the industry. Like, people came to me because I did kind of a lot of out of the box stuff. And then now that we are an operations agency, I specialize in teams of 10 and under. And that is specifically one, because I have been a teacher. I taught K through 5. I also taught adult workforce and I trained professional development for the city. So we specialize in teams of 10 and under. So I can make a point to sit with every single team member. Like, I don't care if you're the CEO or the admin assistant. When you hire me, you're going to get time with me, regardless of what your role is on that team. That is primarily our focus with our one-on-one work, right? So we say we help freelancers evolve into badass CEOs. But with that, that's more of like our coaching, and our one-on-one work is usually people who have at least like 3 contractors on their team, and then they have employees. But we've worked with everyone. I do so much nonprofit work because honestly, like, that's where my heart is. I love just seeing the way that people help their communities. We're working with a client right now out of Boston that they host these like health hubs for low-income neighborhoods. And so they sit and they come in, they talk about COVID, they talk about the flu shot, they talk about ways to just really live like healthy lifestyles. And it's really fascinating because they don't have client deliverables. That's kind of like the first nonprofit I've interacted with that isn't government grant founded. They're kind of more of like a tech seed company in a way, which has been really fun. We've worked with all kinds of things. I worked with, oh my God, one of my first Notion clients, I worked with a wind turbine repair company. And I built like an employee tracking database in Notion for them. So like, literally, when I say, I don't care what you do, it's about you caring about your community and moving people forward. But yeah, the small teams thing, that's really kind of that key. I don't have any desire to work with a company like Oracle on a bigger scale. Now, maybe they had like a design team internally. Maybe. I worked for Dell for a while and, you know, they have really cool internal small teams. So that's something that I've explored as a goal of working with long term, but it's not like a make or break for me.
Specifically for small agencies, whether it be a team of like 2 to 3, whether it is a marketing agency, brand strategy, digital advertising, based on your experience, what do you think are some of the biggest operations and systems mistakes that those types of businesses in that sort of under 10 growth phase are making right now?
I will speak on personally what I think and then give kind of a follow-up to that. I have seen in my experience, most of the clients that I have worked with kind of just picked software based on what other people were telling them to pick, and they didn't know what they needed when they picked that. I get a lot of people, specifically marketing client-based, right? Like when we think about client-based businesses, they were told, oh, you need HoneyBook, or you need Dubsado, or you need to use X because that's what your industry is using. And it's so fascinating to look at the design space, because I do work with a lot of designers and smaller design agencies, is they have no idea what their process looks like when you take the industry influence out of it, right? How do you run discovery calls? How do you do client management? How do you do offboarding and retainer work that's custom to you and your business, and not what the industry is telling you what you're supposed to do? I don't care. If you don't want to do discovery calls, who the fuck cares, right? But the software that they're doing to execute all of these phases within their client journeys are based on what they're being told is the best tool. And so when we get connected, it's kind of this weird experience, because they're like, yeah, like this never really worked for me, and I don't really know why I'm on it. And so it's been really fun to kind of do this exploration strategy sessions with these clients and going, oh, I didn't know I needed a form tool, or I didn't know that there was actually a better way to automate my business because the software I have right now doesn't even have that feature. And so they're not even thinking about automation. So that's kind of the follow-up to that. I couldn't tell you how many calls I get on with clients that are like, yeah, I spend like 2 to 3 hours writing proposals and contracts. And I'm like, why? Why is that process not automated? Why are you writing a custom contract for every single client? That makes no sense to me. And so I do a lot of kind of that coaching stuff of how can we better operate your business, because human error is literally the number one downfall for people losing money in their business. One of my deliverables with people is I reduce your human error through automation. So what repetitive stuff can we get rid of? What can we improve? I call it remove, improve, and automate. That's kind of our three key focuses. Yeah. And then I think too, you know, just as like kind of a third touch, is it's interesting because I primarily work with online businesses. And so it's interesting because a lot of these companies got started post-COVID, or they were kind of trickling before COVID and the pandemic, and they've never really thought about what remote work looks like and what async work looks like. And so I actually wrote this essay that kind of took off a little bit about what I call the cubicle crutch. And it is the fact that you are leaning on Slack and you have at any moment the ability to message someone and ask questions instead of doing the work yourself and like finding those answers. And so a lot of the work that we do too is how can we stop relying on the individual's knowledge and focus more on the tools to help us give us that knowledge. Because again, it doesn't matter who's in the role. If the job is not getting done, it doesn't matter. We need to take the actual person, Sarah, out of CEO, and CEO should still operate, no matter who's in that role.
I really liked your perspective on how a certain industry tends to gravitate towards one set of tools just because that's what other people are using, but they're not able to kind of remove the industry from that and choose a tool that's actually doing the things that they need. And the reason why I like that so much is it has been a big focus about how we've gone about developing Motion.io.
There is no software that I've come across, at least in my first 3 years, that spoke only to creative design businesses, right? Like, yes, you have Dubsado, but they don't really speak directly to designers. HoneyBook, designers use it like the back of their hand, but it was built for photographers. Like, it's not a design company. And so it wasn't until I actually found Kitchen that was the first time I saw a website of a productivity tool specifically speaking to creatives, which was really fascinating to me. And so I almost like challenge you guys to maybe not. Like, yeah, you can have these other clients, but I think it would do y'all so well to keep that language of like, this is for design creatives, because no one's really doing that. And it's such a shame because it's such a lost market. It's forgotten. No one's doing it.
Wanted to end our episode here with a couple fun questions and then kind of business question to close it
sure.
out. My first question for you would be, where do you go for inspiration? Who do you look to? Who do you admire? What inspires you? Who inspires you?
I'm very much an anarchist and I don't follow anyone in my space very closely, to be honest. You kind of ask the question like, you know, if you could have dinner with anybody, like who's your biggest inspiration? And for me, it's Anthony Bourdain. I'm a big foodie. I'm a home chef. I don't buy processed food. Like I make all my own breads, my own pastas, my own sauces. I grew up in the food world. I literally reread Kitchen Confidential every year, specifically an audiobook, because I love hearing his voice.
The narrator of...
Yes.
No way.
Because I've read the book. You need to listen to it on audiobook. It's
wow.
so good. I got to meet Anthony Bourdain at South By 2 years before he died, because CNN used to do a South By party and it used to not be a private invite only. And so he was premiering Parts Unknown, the new season. They had flown out this chef from Spain who was like fresh cutting prosciutto with champagne. Oh my God, it was one of the coolest experiences. But for me, with Anthony Bourdain, what I love is he literally doesn't give a fuck. He knows like the grit and the grime, and he's not afraid to really talk about the reality of things. And I feel like that is what I miss in our space now. Like, I don't get that from anybody. Everyone is so tailored on being perfect on the internet, not saying the wrong thing. And so I really struggle with like, I want to talk about like basketball and the fun shit I'm, you know, like outside of business on Twitter, but it's like, no, it has to be curated and you're always talking to your niche and all of this. And so I think that's why I love Anthony Bourdain so much, is he's like, I'm going to talk about the fact that I did drugs and I was on drugs, and I'm listening to Confidential right now. This is my annual re-listen. And in one of the chapters, he talks about how they used to finish a night of cooking and would go drive out to Long Island and just get fucking toasted. And they would sleep on the beach until 3-4 in the afternoon until they had to get up and go back to work and keep cooking. And like that was their whole summer for multiple years. That's the kind of stuff I love. Another person, though, that I'm really inspired by is Shea Serrano. If you are a basketball head or you ever follow The Ringer, Shea is based in San Antonio. And when I was an undergrad, I wrote my senior thesis on how people in the rap game are actually historians, because mass media is not covering inner city equality. They're not covering events other than like murder, right? Like there's so much more. There's so much culture to these inner cities, and rappers are actually the ones that are historizing things. And so one day on Twitter, he was like, you know, send me whatever you're writing. And I'm like, he's never going to fucking see this, right? Like, I'm, you know what? Fine. Like, I'm just going to ship it, because I like turned it into a blog post, and he ended up retweeting it, and it got me 3 different writing jobs. And that to me, like,
wow,
he is so focused on, no matter where he's at, reaching back and pulling people up. And so that totally changed my perspective on life, is like, you don't have to hit a certain success level. You don't have to make a certain amount of money to reach back and help somebody up. God, I was maybe like 21 when that happened. Like, I was super young. And so it was funny, because 2 years later, it was Movies and Other Things came out. So that one had come out, and he did a book signing here in Austin. And I'm in line with everybody. I'm like, holy shit, like, I'm about to meet Shea Serrano. Like, this is so dope. And Arturo Torres, who did my Rocky art and the Scottie Pippen art and the basketball dude right here, that's all Arturo's work, who did the illustrations for Shea's book. And I like walked up to the table and I see them. And I'm like, you know, you probably don't remember, but you retweeted my piece. And like, I just want you to know, like, Charlemagne the God ended up retweeting it. I got like 3 different writing jobs from it. It was insane. And he was like, dude, when you get to where I'm at, I expect you to do the same thing. And that has stuck with me for 8-9 years now. It's been since that happened. Those two people, man, I love them.
Both of those stories are incredible. And it, especially for me, I actually was not super familiar with Shea Serrano until right now. I love that approach, though. And now I'm going to have to like do research later today. That whole idea of, if somebody helped you along the way, you better be doing the same thing once you get to a place. There's so many people I can think of who have been just fundamental to my career and my growth. And then I just love the Anthony Bourdain thing. I've been obsessed with Anthony Bourdain, I think, as long as I can remember. Since the earliest seasons of No Reservations, I was just like instantly hooked. I'm like, who is this guy? And it gave me so much of my ideology that I have today about travel, about food, but more importantly, people. And it comes back to what we said at the beginning of this episode, like listening to people and hearing about their experiences. This past year, we went to Morocco. We were there in Ramadan, right? And I was really sort of blown away by Ramadan and the experience there and seeing the way that it brings people together and the way that an entire place in this entire town was sharing this same experience simultaneously. It was like really magic because we were eating like the after sunset dinner with people and just like hearing about their experiences. And I just gained this whole new level of respect that I would have never had if I wasn't open to those things and if I didn't get some of those lessons earlier on. So
that's the key, I think, to just living a good life is like read a book that you wouldn't normally read. Watch somebody's video that comes up on your For You page or your YouTube algorithm that you wouldn't normally listen to. Go to a workshop. Expand your horizon. There's so much more than what's in your immediate digital and physical backyard. You think about being a kid and like all of your ideas and your exploration and the world you used to create. And it's like, why did we lose that? Why are we so afraid to go explore, try on a new outfit that we don't normally wear, make food that we don't. You know, I'm cooking through Leigh Hall right now. I'm kind of doing the Julia Child thing, that woman who cooked through all of Julia Child's recipes and her cookbooks, but I'm not doing it very, you know, strictly. But that's just been fun to be like, oh, I can try this new thing or I can test this new skill. And you know what? If it turns out like shit, who cares? At least I tried.
Could not agree more. Before I move on to my final question of this episode, I do just want to share this fact because I found it mind-blowing and I can't resist just because I know that you're a foodie, you love cooking. Julia Childs, did you know this? So she was in the military and one of her first jobs was creating the chemicals that would repel sharks away from the bombs that they would put in the water.
And also that people thought her and her husband were the CIA.
Yeah. I was reading through her Wikipedia page. I'm like, what is that? Because I watched
Childs
the movie about
the
Julia Childs.
Julia Childs
is
fascinating people.
Yo, Julia, you like, you are a badass. I thought you were just this sweet little lady who cooked French food.
Turns out, she's like, very tall, very outspoken. Yeah.
Final question of our episode today. And first, I want to say thank you so much, Sarah, for coming on, sharing your time, your expertise, your stories. It's been just a blast chatting with you. We quickly blew through our entire hour just because I was having so much fun.
It makes me sad. Like we got to do a Joe Rogan stint one day and just like sit here for like 4 hours and record it.
Oh, I am absolutely down. I should have booked this for longer in hindsight.
So good. Okay.
But my final question for you, what is new and exciting going on with your business and where should people go to learn more?
Yeah, so we are actually in the process of launching a cohort-based course called Systems Club that is launching early February, and it's not Notion-based. So I say this in the sales copies, like, I don't give a shit what software you use because you're going to bring your processes to our course, and we're going to go through, we're going to automate, audit, implement, teach you how to document your process. And then inside, you also get paired with an accountability buddy to build your collective network, because I don't believe there's competition anywhere, but you really have to maximize on who your partners are. And so within here, you get paired with like somebody in a complementary business. So if you're a web designer, you get paired with a copywriter, brand designer, web designer, et cetera. It's a 6-week cohort-based course. You get lifetime access to our community, though. We've got master classes. We've got bonus calls. I have somebody coming in talking about contracts. My financial advisor is going to come in and talk about business credit and your equity building and things like that. I'm really proud of it. It's really coming together and it's kind of a collective of all the things I've tried in the past 4 years and really how I provide value to people in kind of one big, beautiful swoop. And it's not expensive like most coaching programs. So it's under $1,000 for 6 weeks and it's a really good time. Other than that, I pretty much only hang out on Twitter now. So you can find me at the Sarah Loretta, no H. And then everything that we offer, my Notion templates, you know, if you want to work one-on-one with me, that's on our website, which is systems without the E.club. And don't spell without the E. It's just systems, S-Y-S-T-M-S. .club, and you'll find everything there.
Amazing stuff. Sarah, thank you so much again. If anybody's interested in checking out Sarah's work, learning more about her, check out the links in this episode's show notes. And until next time, thank you so much, Sarah, and see you next week, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thanks, y'all.